Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's easy to find a reason to visit Lake Tahoe, and July 4th is one of the most popular reasons for tourists. Hundreds of thousands of people have been known to celebrate Independence Day across the Tahoe Basin. But along with festivities from one end of the lake to the other and across state line is a familiar downer come the morning of July 5th. All that trash that's left behind. For the past decade, the League to Save Lake Tahoe, also known as Keep Tahoe Blue, spends that morning cleaning up all the litter that's left behind. And this year, which is its 10-year anniversary, it set a record for the amount of trash that was picked up, more than 8,000 pounds, with one spot a particular eyesore. But the nonprofit says there's some good news within all of that litter. Darcy Goodman-Collin is the CEO of the League to Save Lake Tahoe, joined by volunteer Naomi Morgan. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good morning, Vicky.
Good morning. Okay, Darcy, I want to start with you. Before we get into this year's record cleanup, let's start from the beginning. 10 years ago, why did this annual cleanup begin?
Such a great question. I started in my role as CEO about 11 years ago. So I'd been in the role and I realized that we had a litter problem, but beyond that, there weren't a lot of efforts for education. And so we really started the community-based cleanup program to educate in a way to engage our community, our visitors, in the work that we were doing to keep Tahoe blue. And we realized that there was a lot more that we can do with that cleanup program. So we immediately started utilizing that program to collect data on what type of trash we were collecting. And that's something that's extremely important to the League to Save Lake Tahoe. All of our community-based programs, all of our citizen science programs collect data on for information to help us inform management decisions. So that first year, 10 years ago, we had over 100 volunteers, only a couple of sites, but we were able to start identifying what the trash issues were and what types of trash we were collecting and where. And we have used that information to inform and encourage and advocate for some really important policy decisions here in Tahoe.
When I think of, you know, pretty easy outreach or something that I see a lot, I think of that sticker, Keep Tahoe Blue, which is on businesses and vehicles. You know, how is that in line with the League's mission?
Well, a lot of people have that Keep Tahoe Blue sticker as the I Love Tahoe sticker. It's iconic. You could see it all over the world. And we're very grateful that that message has reached so many people. But not everyone knows that there is an organization behind that slogan and that it's an actual call, rallying call to action. And the intent is that we all need to keep Tahoe blue. In order to protect this lake, it takes everyone involved. And that's why our volunteers are so magnificent. They model behavior that we hope our community and our visitors alike will look at, will understand, and will replicate when they come to Tahoe.
All right, Naomi, that brings me to you. When did you become a volunteer?
Oh, gosh, that was back in 2013. I wanted to volunteer with the League because I wanted to give back to my community. I really wanted to keep Lake Tahoe clean and healthy so my family could enjoy it and so everyone else could as well.
How has it been in the last, 10 years of doing this and taking part in the cleanups every July 5th?
It's been interesting. So when we first started cleaning up, there was a lot of trash out there, but it wasn't as bad as it has been recently. Just more and more people have learned how wonderful Lake Tahoe is and have definitely come to our area to enjoy the lake. But often they leave behind some things that should not be there.
Well, Darcy, then that brings me to this year, right? Because your nonprofit recorded more than 8,500 pounds of trash. And that was just over the course of 3 hours on the morning of July 5th. What locations did volunteers visit?
Well, this year was a bittersweet year because, as you mentioned, Vicky, we're celebrating our 10th anniversary of this event. And that's heartwarming because over that time, we've had so many volunteers come out to help us. But this year, we also experienced the largest amount of trash collected, partially because we had more volunteers than we've had, in years in the past. But also there was one site that was the largest culprit. So I think it's worth noting that of our different sites, we had 6 different sites around the lake, most of them had less trash than in previous years. So we are learning. We're working with our management land manager partners like the U.S. Forest Service and state parks, and we're learning how to provide the resources for our visitors so that they can model the right behavior. But there are some sites like this site in called Zephyr Shoals on the Nevada side of the lake that did have that large amount of trash. And it's likely that that area was the biggest culprit because we are getting better at managing the other sites. So that site doesn't have the management that some of the surrounding sites have and the restrictions. So the concentration of party goers during the 4th of July up here celebrating the 4th, one of the best places in the world, I must say, to celebrate, they got concentrated in that one area. And with the water levels very high this year, they were really concentrated. The beach size is much smaller, so they were all packed into that one area.
Are trash resources like garbage bins and management, such as like, you know, having staff, is it different on the California versus Nevada side?
It's not different because the entire basin is a collaborative. We have a collaborative relationship with all of the different agencies. So I wouldn't say there's a difference between the two states. We have the U.S. Forest Service manages over almost 80% of our land. So there's that consistency. However, some of the individual beaches are managed differently. And that one particular area did not have restrictions or regulations. The Forest Service did bring in more trash cans and other resources. So there was more infrastructure this year, but the regulation is not the same as it is in some of those managed areas.
Hmm. Naomi, which location were you at?
I was at the Kings Beach location, which is in the north, towards the north side of Lake Tahoe.
Yeah. And how was it in the morning?
Actually, it wasn't horrible. There were some floating devices floating around there on the beach and in the water we were able to pick up. But the amount of trash was much less than what I have noticed in the last few years.
Hmm. Darcy, can you explain how the Tahoe Basin acts like kind of like a giant granite funnel? That's how you've described it.
Yeah. One of the reasons why Lake Tahoe is so clear is it's a very small watershed. So that means that it drains a small amount of land into the lake, and the lake is over 70% of that actual surface area. So that is gives us an opportunity to have very clean water, but also anything that is on the land is going to make its way into the water pretty quickly. And that includes trash. So if there's litter upstream, it's likely it's going to make its way into the lake. And that's one of the reasons why our litter program is so important. If we can be the last line of defense for the lake and capture that litter, then we're protecting it from getting into the lake. Once it gets into the lake, it can turn into things like microplastic and be in that system for ages.
Yeah, because you don't even have to be a volunteer, you know, to just see the images of the trash that was left behind that your organization shared. I mean, it's just shocking and just striking that amount of trash was left behind, you know, overly on the Nevada side at Zephyr Shoals. I mean, on the one hand, it must feel like such a huge relief, you know, once it's cleared, like lifting all of that trash off of Tahoe. But how does it feel to initially take in what, you know, a lot of people just left behind?
It's such a bittersweet occurrence for me every year, because I get to the beaches in the morning and you're devastated. And then within 20 minutes, volunteers start showing up and you regain your faith in humanity, because there's individuals who've been coming to these cleanups for years. A lot of them are out of town. Naomi herself, she lives down in Reno. So it's not just locals that care about the environment and care about Lake Tahoe. And one interesting thing that happened this year that was slightly different than other years is that impressive image of that one beach that you've all probably seen with the trash. It looked like a landfill. We immediately started posting those pictures on social media. And we had maybe 20 volunteers that signed up for that site prior to participate in the cleanup. But immediately after posting those images, people started showing up. And we had almost triple the amount that originally signed up to help clean the beach. Mm-hmm. And the Forest Service, who owns and manages that area, they did increase their resources that day as well. So they had a bunch of their team helping clean up. So it was a joint effort. And the message that got out, I'm hoping, is what's lasting. Those images, sure, they stick in your mind, but the images of the volunteers showing up and the camaraderie and how much people love the lake and want everyone to do their part to protect it. That's what I'm hoping the message is moving forward.
You know, Naomi, you're one of the volunteers. You're also, you know, a steward when you're not volunteering, you know, just acting in good behavior, you know, that benefits the lake. How does this type of volunteer work that you've committed to shape your understanding of why people leave litter and trash behind?
I think often it's an accident for a lot of people. Often they're distracted by other things. I don't think people do it on purpose, but I'm not sure how much of the messages that they get as children and adults gets through to them that they really do need to keep the land clean and the waters clean. I mean, I even remember when I was a kid, there was Woodsy the owl who would let us know, pick up your litter. Otherwise, you know, it'll be a mess. So it's been ingrained in me from a young age, but I don't know about now in the current age how much they hear about it, except from places like the League.
Darcy, when it comes to how trash and litter has evolved over the last 10 years that you've been doing these cleanups, what are kind of like the worst things that you can overlook and leave behind?
One of our biggest trash culprits are cigarette butts. We've had a huge cigarette campaign over the course of the 10 years. It's easy. I think it's easy to think of the beach as a ashtray. So, and it's hard. Those things are easy to lose and they get ingrained into the sand and not picked up when people leave. So we have a special program in which we are collecting and learning about where the biggest issues are for cigarette butts. And then during our cleanups, we also take all the cigarette butts we collect and get them recycled. And we started putting up messaging and cigarette canisters around the lake. So that's been helpful. But some of the cigarettes we're collecting are historic because you get down there and they've been there for a while. Then we've also collected all different types of plastic. That's probably our tied for cigarette butts, one of the biggest culprits. And the data that we've been collecting, that our volunteers have been collecting on the types and amount of plastic, have been instrumental in policy changes here in Tahoe. We first got the city of South Lake Tahoe to pass the ban on the single-use plastic bag sale, and then styrofoam as well. And then most recently, the city of South Lake Tahoe passed a ban on the sale of single-use plastic water bottles, actually one of the first in the state of California to do that. And I truly believe that those things wouldn't have happened if we didn't have the data to show that it was an issue. Because when people come to Tahoe, unless it's immediately after the 4th of July, it's pristine. And that's what people remember. So sometimes it's hard to understand that there really still is a problem. And so the data and then the volunteers as advocates have helped us make some really strong and progressive moves up here in Tahoe to protect the lake.
Yeah, even something small like a cigarette butt or maybe like a cocktail straw, you know, I mean, those are some of the hardest things or stubborn things to pick up.
Exactly. And then those degrade and become microplastic. And we're finding there are microplastics in Lake Tahoe. And if they're in Lake Tahoe, that means they're everywhere. But what can we do on the land side to prevent plastics getting into Tahoe?
Well, Darcy and Naomi, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much.
Very much.
Darcy Goodman-Collin is the CEO of the League to Save Lake Tahoe, also known as Keep Tahoe Blue, joined by volunteer Naomi Morgan. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. For the second year in a row, the U.S. Supreme Court has reversed decades of legal precedent with impacts that could last generations. In a 6-3 ruling, the High Court effectively ended affirmative action nationwide. By declaring race can no longer be a factor in the admissions process, the ruling forces colleges and universities to find other ways to cultivate a diverse student body. That's something that California public universities have been attempting for decades. In 1996, California voters banned race-based admissions at public universities. The University of California actually filed an amicus brief to the Supreme Court supporting affirmative action, saying that despite more than 25 years of finding alternatives, campuses still struggle to enroll a diverse student body. But there are success stories, and we don't have to travel that far. UC Davis has one of the most diverse medical school programs in the country without affirmative action. So we're going to start our conversation here. Joining us is Dr. Mark Henderson, Associate Dean for Admissions at the UC Davis School of Medicine. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Vicki.
Dr. Henderson, you have a unique perspective of what's to come for colleges and universities across the country following the Supreme Court decision. Having navigated the admissions process yourself, how do you think this ruling will shape future student bodies?
Well, I think if we use California as an example, as you mentioned, in 1996, when affirmative action was banned here, the diversity of the public schools such as UC Berkeley and UCLA really suffered, particularly with respect to the Latino and African-American student population. So many would predict the same thing going forward in other parts of the U.S., including medical schools, unless they take major steps to, I suppose, prevent that decline.
Within higher education, how has the diversity of medical schools evolved over the years and decades?
Well, I think in California, again, we've, since I've been in this position as Associate Dean for Admissions, we've been able to operate in this environment, if you will, an anti-affirmative action environment. And really, we've done it through a host of measures. I think we use a very broad and multi-pronged process that includes a holistic assessment of every applicant's potential to help meet workforce needs in California. As a public school, UC Davis is one that aims to train physicians who will help address our state's diverse healthcare needs, and particularly for communities that have difficulty accessing medical care, such as rural Californians. So sticking to that mission, I think, has been a key part of our success and other schools' success.
Yeah, and you have had some success as well. What have been some of the important learning lessons that you and your colleagues have learned in pursuit of having a student body that's reflective of the state demographics?
Yes, I think principally by including individuals from communities that have struggled with healthcare or in many ways been left out of healthcare, they bring a lived experience and a deep understanding of the barriers that are experienced by many of our patients, honestly. And when you have that lived experience, when you have that understanding, I think it's easier for you to both relate to many patients from all walks of life, as well as to earn their trust when you ask them to take a medication or to undergo a procedure that you think they need. You know, there's, you know, I think a lot of times people think what you do as a physician is know a lot. And certainly that's important. You have to know a lot, but you also have to be able to earn the trust of your patients in almost any part of medicine. Otherwise, they won't be able to move forward with the treatment plan that you've developed.
Yeah. When you talk about having a holistic approach to the admissions process, I mean, that sounds very nuanced, and it depends on each individual with their unique lived experiences and circumstances. One tool that your medical school uses is an adversity score. How does that work?
Sure. Well, to be clear, it's not really an adversity score as many have described. What the Davis scale is really just a small part of that process that I alluded to earlier, where we try to assess each candidate's potential to help meet the workforce needs. It uses basically a number of socioeconomic variables that are contained in every medical school application. And it's basically an estimate of the rough estimate of the barriers encountered by an individual applicant, whether they be economic or educational, such as, let's say, having to work your way through college. And we believe that the ability to overcome such obstacles is a reflection of grit, resilience, commitment, as well, again, as the ability to connect and establish trust with patients from all walks of life. These qualities, while not talked about, I think are super important for physicians in California and frankly anywhere. Again, a tool is just one part of our much bigger process that includes grades, test scores, and the usual things that you might think about healthcare experience, et cetera.
Hmm. How does taking that into account, the way that UC Davis does, how does it differ from other medical schools' admissions processes?
Well, I think every medical school, the Association of American Medical Colleges compels us to consider our mission when we develop an admissions process and to make our processes and practices concordant with that mission. So for us, it's relatively easy to focus on health equity, health disparities, again, trying to reach out to and represent historically marginalized or excluded communities so that we can improve care for all Californians. I think the way our process differs, I'm not sure, you know, the process across the country is quite variable. I will say our outcomes differ principally in that we have many, many students from low-income families. That is something that's very different for medical education in this country.
I would imagine it was different when you went to medical school.
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, I, as someone who worked throughout college and in part during medical school as well, I think that, those kinds of experiences, again, helped me relate to patients. And that those kinds of things were very, very helpful when I became a primary care physician, again, because you have to be able to relate to patients. They have to be able to relate to you if you want them to follow your advice. But again, I think most medical students, if you will, come from maybe the more upper income categories is generally, if you look at the distribution of, let's say, economic representation in medical schools, it's not very broad.
Given that UC Davis Medical School has become among the most diverse in the country, I mean, you have, I believe, over 40% of your recent class are first-generation college students. Are other colleges and universities reaching out to you, especially following this Supreme Court ruling about, you know, what they can learn for you from your school and as potentially even a framework to apply to their admissions process?
Yes, I mean, I think we've had inquiries from dozens of medical schools in the past few weeks, and we are trying to do as much as we can to share. You know, again, I'd say going back to the mission, the reason you exist as a medical school is very, very important, and to sort of redouble your efforts. You know, medicine is a public good, as you know. A large parts of the medical education system are financed by public tax dollars. The trust fund, the Medicare trust fund finances huge portions of medical education. So we as medical schools, I think, have a duty to produce a workforce that helps solve some of the healthcare needs of our regions, of our states, of the nation.
Hmm. You know, there is some potential criticism. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, he warned that using proxies for race-like socioeconomic rankings, they could also potentially face legal challenges. Do you think this could impact your medical school?
Well, I mean, I think legal challenges are always out there. As I said, as a public school with a mission to serve California and really to produce physicians for all Californians, we feel strongly we're doing the right thing. And so sometimes, you know, you have to just proceed and let the chips fall where they may. I think critics may erroneously assume we admit students who are somehow less than because they come from more humble backgrounds. I would assert that these individuals actually bring more to the table, both clinically and in a research setting. Their lived experience is value added. Their passion for improving healthcare for all is critical to achieving health equity in this country. So I'm not that worried.
Yeah, ahead of the Supreme Court decision in June, the American Medical Association, they met in Chicago, and they adopted a new policy that opposes the use of legacy status, and that's essentially preference based on family or alumni, as a tool for screening medical school applicants. Do you think that this is an important step in the right direction, ensuring a medical workforce is reflective of the populations that they serve?
Well, yes, the AMA is concerned that the current physician workforce is not representative of the broader society or nation. And I happen to agree. And really, it's not just my opinion. If you look at it, legacy applicants come from a very narrow segment of society. And for the reasons I've already stated, that is health inequities, we're actually trying to broaden representation, not narrow it. Again, make it more like society at large.
Finally, Dr. Henderson, if someone is interested in applying to medical school, maybe at UC Davis, but, you know, given that you have a lot of first generation college students, what would you like them to know if they feel intimidated or they don't know if it's possible?
Well, I'd say, first of all, medicine is hard. It's a wonderful career, but it's much more like a marathon than a sprint, as the saying goes. Most of our students at UC Davis have actually had a few years of life or healthcare experience prior to applying to medical school, which we believe adds to their potential as future physicians. So I guess my advice would simply be, make sure you're up for the duration of the race and in the process, as much as, I mean, be yourself and try to highlight the experiences that you bring to the table that will improve the care of your future patients. Mm.
Dr. Mark Henderson is an Associate Dean for Admissions at the UC Davis School of Medicine. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Vicki.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're discussing the Supreme Court's ruling on affirmative action, effectively banning race from being taken into account during the college admissions process. We're going to continue the conversation by speaking with Lance Izumi, Senior Director of Education Studies at the Pacific Research Institute, to learn why he supports the Supreme Court's decision. Welcome, Lance.
Well, thank you very much, Vicki. I appreciate your invitation to be on your show today.
Yep. Thank you for making the time. So you have described this decision as a step in the right direction. In your view, what is the right direction?
Well, I think that, the Supreme Court based its decision on the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and specifically the Equal Protection Clause. And that means that every American in this country, regardless of the race that they happen to belong to or that they claim, is entitled to an equal application of the laws in their situation, and that you cannot use race to disadvantage that person, because in doing so, what you do is you actually violate this constitutional provision that they are entitled to the equal application of American law. And I think that what the Supreme Court did in this decision was to ensure that ideal that has always been enunciated by this court, but which has along the way, become unfortunately encrusted with some exceptions to that rule, that the court finally decided, and they said this in their decision, that eliminating discrimination means eliminating it all. And I think that that's what this court did. And I think, specifically what they did in regards to, because the plaintiffs is in the Harvard case were Asian American applicants. And so these applicants, unfortunately, for many of them, were treated in an unequal fashion, and that, they had a much lower chance of getting into Harvard despite their academic credentials. And so therefore, the Supreme Court found that there was an unequal application of the laws based upon the 14th Amendment to these Asian American applicants. And that's why they eventually decided in this case to strike down race preferences in college admissions. Mm.
But there are also, on the flip side, there are a number of Asian American groups that have spoken out against the court's decision. You know, they claim affirmative action has played a beneficial role in ensuring a pathway to higher education for many people in their community. And these groups also pointed out that there weren't really any Asian American students who physically stepped forward in the lawsuit to say that they've been discriminated against. So do you think politics played a role, you know, in why this lawsuit was brought about?
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, there's politics always, you know, in you know, any kind of public policy that you're trying to change. But I will say that, you know, and those Asian groups that, you know, oppose this decision, obviously they're free to have their view on this. But I do think that if you talk to the average Asian American parent and student who is trying to go through this college admissions process, they really worry a lot about you know, how their race is going to affect them. And so, I mean, it's common knowledge within the Asian community, for example, that when you're applying for college and they get this advice, oftentimes from advisors, college advisors that you know, will tell them, if you're Asian, don't make a big thing of that in your college essay application, or don't include a photograph of yourself, because that may end up being a negative mark against you in the college admissions process. So, you know, again, regardless of what these other groups may say, if you look again at, you know, what the average American, Asian American family is dealing with, that's what they're dealing with. And that's the worry that has always been there for many years.
When we're talking about Asian American, that's such a broad term, right? There's so many countries that fit and cultures that fit into Asian American. What are you talking specifically about, certain countries and certain cultures, or just all of them?
No, that is a really important point, Vicky. And I think the reason that's so important is because Chief Justice Roberts, in his majority opinion in this case, underscored the fact that the problem with using the category Asians is that it is so over-inclusive of people. And so therefore you have, he pointed out that you have people from South Asia, let's say Indians or Pakistanis, to people from Far East Asia, like Japan and China. You know, I'm Japanese American. But all these different cultures in Asia are very different from each other. There is no one quote unquote Asian culture. So when we talk about diversity, and those who are unhappy with this decision will say, well, this decision will impact diversity on campuses. Well, you know, you have to look at what the category of Asians means. Asia encompasses about 60% of the world's population. And you have, you know, people who are Muslims, you have people who are Christians, you have people who are Buddhists and Hindus. You have this incredible cross-section of world population in Asia, and it's incredibly diverse. And so when you just say that, you know, talk about Asians, I think that people may have the stereotype. And this is one of the things that the court hammered on, is the fact that we cannot allow the use of a term like Asians to end up as a stereotype for that group.
So given that we actually can look to California and see how this has played out, how have you come to understand the fact that the University of California, when they filed an amicus brief to the Supreme Court supporting affirmative action, the chancellors at these campuses said that despite more than 25 years of trying to find alternatives, campuses still struggle to enroll a diverse student body, especially more elite universities within the U.S. UC system like UCLA and Berkeley?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things, Vicky. I mean, first of all, I think it's ironic that, you know, the UC folks would do that in a state where the voters have overwhelmingly voted in favor of race neutral college admissions.
It was 55%.
55%.
Yes.
But then when the effort to overturn it was made a year or two ago, it was a 57% majority that voted against the effort to overturn Prop 209. So, you know, so a lot of Californians, you know, want to have a race neutral college admission system. And I think that, though, that, you know, one of the problems with focusing on this issue of college admissions solely is that it overlooks the fact that the universities are suffering from a very difficult pipeline from the K-12 system. And if you look, for example, at what the UC Academic Senate in a 2020 study that they put out, they found that the reason why there is such a difficulty in increasing the number of underrepresented minorities in the UC system is because the K-12 pipeline is not providing them with the students that would take the A through G college preparatory courses that would make them eligible for UC enrollment. And the chancellor at that time, Janet Napolitano, also confirmed that the real problem is the lack of underrepresented minorities taking the A through G courses. And so if we really want to improve the numbers of underrepresented minorities in the UC system, which I think everybody would love to see that, is to increase the pool of students who are eligible to come in. And so it doesn't help to have high income underrepresented minority students only at UC. A lot of those students who are not being able to apply even to UC are underrepresented minorities from very poor areas. And so therefore, I think that we need to ensure that those kids are getting that type of education that would make them eligible for UC enrollment, at the end of their K-12 career.
Given that K through 12 public schools, especially in underrepresented communities, I mean, they arguably bear the most responsibility, as you say, you say that they bear the most responsibility, but also they're facing a lot of serious challenges when it comes to staffing and funding and just overall resources for these students. What are some solutions in the interim, to help the public school system to make sure that the applicant pool is reflective?
Well, I think that one of the things that they could do right off the bat is look at other states that have been able to really turn around the performance of those kids who are in at-risk categories, who are in underrepresented categories. I mean, all of us here in California, we always like to laugh at Mississippi as being always at the end of the education train. But Mississippi, if you look at what they did in the mid-2010s, they totally changed the way they implemented reading instruction in the classroom. And so they went from whatever they were doing before to a very scientific research-based reading instructional program that emphasized phonics, for example. But what they did, what the impact of this was that Mississippi went amongst its low-income students, those kids who, I'm sure California would love to have in the UC system, they went from amongst the worst performing reading scores in the country to, by 2022, second in the country in just a really short period of time. And so it wasn't necessarily that Mississippi decided to spend a boatload of money. What they decided to do was to change their educational program to reflect what really works in the classroom. And it had a huge impact on the students there. And what that does for Mississippi is that it increases the pool of those kids who are now going to be eligible probably for higher education institutions in Mississippi and out of state. So I think that's something that we can do, especially when you look at the fact that here in California, our reading scores, our math scores, those core basic subjects, that there is overwhelming lack of proficiency among students in K-12 in these underrepresented minority communities.
We have about 20 seconds left. I'm just curious if in the coming years, if diversity drops at colleges and universities across the country, how will you square that? Is that an outcome in line with this decision?
Well, again, I think that what this decision does is it puts pressure on all kinds of different players to not allow that to happen. So that, Professor Henderson was talking about ways that they're increasing enrollment amongst underrepresented minorities using race-neutral ways. And I think that that's what these universities have to do. But the most important thing is that they need to improve the eligibility pool of kids from those underrepresented minority groups.
Lance, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Vicky. I appreciate the invitation.
Lance Izumi is a senior director of education studies at the Pacific Research Institute. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Learning an instrument is a big accomplishment, but an Elk Grove teen has taken that skill and that passion to a whole new level. Neil Nayar can play more than 100 instruments. Many are rare instruments from all over the world. This extraordinary talent has landed him some pretty cool spots on Good Morning America and the Jennifer Hudson Show, so we're going to give you a little taste. And this week, Neil will be heading to Los Angeles for the Recording Academy's Grammy Camp, which is a music industry program for high school students. So Neil Nayar joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. How are you doing?
Doing great. So you joined us last year, and you've had quite a busy year so far. What have been some of your biggest highlights?
Yeah, I think the biggest highlights is the Grammy Camp, which is coming up. Another thing is coming up is called State Fair, which is happening from July 26th. On 2023, from 1:30 p.m. till 2:15 p.m. at the Promenade Stage. Then we have Hosey Music Awards, where I got nominated as the Musician of the Year.
You have a lot of stuff lined up.
A lot of stuff, yes.
Which is great. It's good to be busy. Given that you can play more than 100 instruments and counting, because you're continuing to learn more, what was the first instrument you learned?
Well, the first instrument I learned was the drums at 6 years old. And my parents, they took me to a free drum class in a music school. And after one drum lesson, I was playing the drums like an old pro. I was like, how did I do this? My parents and my drum teacher were shocked. They were like, wow, you just play the drums so fluently. And that's where my journey started.
Yeah, so obviously you have a knack for picking up instruments, but you practice like 6 hours a day. This is a full-time job for you, but it's more than talent for you, given that you are on this trajectory of pretty much learning as many instruments as you can.
Yeah, correct.
You know, why rare is instruments? Some of them are pretty cool and pretty obscure for a lot of people. You know, what attracts you to them?
Well, I think what attracts me to them is the sound and also where it is from. You know, whenever I have like an instrument from India or China, you know, I'm like always so curious about the sound, you know, how it sounds, what's the history behind this instrument, you know, what songs it's used for, what fest, you know, or like, you know, what it is used for and everything. So it's like, it's, you know, music is a big thing. It's like an ocean, you know, it's like all everything, like all genres, everything.
Do other people in your family play music as well?
No, actually my really? Parents do not play music. Actually, my mom tried to learn the violin, but she could not learn the violin.
So how do they come to understand just your gift of being able to pick up instruments so easily?
Well, I think they understood from the moment when I was born. You know, when I was in the mother's womb, my dad, you know, he was reading a book which mentioned if you give Mozart music on the womb, then the child will become a musician. So I think from that time, they understood that I had something. And then in this case, then they decided to see what I could do in music. And then that's where the magic happened.
All right. Well, we're going to listen to some of your compositions. So we're going to start with a portion of a composition called Last Date.
Correct.
Instruments are you using?
So in this piece, I used around probably 10 or 15 instruments. There's like violins, cellos. There are some high-pitched guitar reverb kind of thing. And we have some effects from the computer. So actually, this piece you're listening to is from a film which I composed recently called Last Date. And it talks about two serial killers, by the way. So it's kind of like a thriller suspense.
How romantic.
Yes. And it's from the company, from the film, from the company Mad Wife Productions, who are based in Reno. So this is my second time working with them. The first film I worked with them is called Beyond the Door, which is a thriller suspense theme again. And I'm currently working on a third film at the moment. Plus, I have another film coming up, which I am working, which is a big one, which is called Lottery. It is a full feature film. And as I heard that it is being directed by the sister of a Bollywood star.
Oh, that is awesome. That's going to be a lot of fun. I'm glad that you've kind of made a really fun turn into composing films and scores. So you mentioned Beyond the Door. We actually have a clip that we can listen to. Certainly captured the suspense vibe with that one. What goes into composing with so many instruments? You're one musician. I mean, you gave us an example. You use 10 to 15 instruments. You're composing it yourself. Logistically, I could imagine it might be like kind of hard to keep track.
Yes, it is very hard to keep track. You know, sometimes I have to like find out, okay, I think this instrument might work for this composition. Oh, I don't think that will work. Or like, you know, it's a different thing because, as I mentioned, music is a big thing. So, and music is very important in films. Like, just imagine what would happen if films had no music. It would be like just blank, just dialogues. But the music, it like brings up the power and the feelings into that scene or in the film, you know.
Mm. Given that, I mean, you mentioned that your family doesn't really play musical instruments. I mean, you're kind of a first in this, and obviously you've taken it to like a whole new level. But you're so thoughtful. You're so young and you're so thoughtful about how you approach music and the role music can play in our lives. Where do you get that inspiration from? Did you have mentors or musicians that you looked up to?
Well, yes, I do have teachers. I think by count, I have like worked with over 100 teachers, like who have taught me music properly and everything. So yeah, you know, I get inspired by them. I also do get inspired by artists. You know, like including the bands like Imagine Dragons, Coldplay, artists like Stevie Wonder, Bruno Mars, Adele. So yeah, I always do get inspiration from different artists.
So at the end of this week, you're going to be heading to Grammy Camp that is in Los Angeles. Tell us about it. What's it about?
So Grammy Camp is a 7-day non-residential industry music program for high school students who are interested in pursuing their career in music. And it will be happening from July 16th till July 22nd at USC, University of Southern California in Los Angeles. So they selected around 80 students across the country to come to Grammy Camp. And, you know, they get selected in 8 career tracks, including instrumental track, audio engineering, electronic music production, music journalism, music business.
Which track are you doing?
This year, I'll be doing instrumental track where I'll be playing guitar in the band. And I also did get selected last year in audio engineering. And it was a great experience. I got to learn from the professionals who work at Grammys. It was a big experience and I loved it so much. Not only that, we also have guest artists who come every year to Grammy Camp. Yeah. Last year, the guest artists we had were Silver Sun Pickups, popular band, and Lauren Spencer Smith, popular singer. But this year, we're having more guest artists. We'll be having Gracie Abrams, American singer-songwriter, G Flip, Australian singer, Moore Kismet, popular DJ, Paul Klein, singer from the band Lani, and Lizzie McAlpine, popular singer and songwriter.
That is awesome, Neil. Well, have a great time and thanks for stopping by.
Of course. Thank you.
Neil Nayar is a teenage musical prodigy from Elk Grove, and he's going to be heading to Grammy Camp, which is from the Recording Academy, because he plays more than 100 instruments. He is a perfect fit. And with that, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.